Thanks very much for the introduction and giving away the rest of my talk. First of all, something interesting. The picture you're seeing here is the result of a bug in the VLC media player. When I ran it to preview some of the animations you'll see later on, I got this picture. It's not what it's supposed to be as you'll see when you see the actual animation, but I found it the most beautiful result of a bug I've ever seen. So, about half a mile away from my office in Athens, Greece, there is the National Archaeological Museum, which in contrast to what we heard in other talks, it's not difficult to find it and photograph it in a really sunny day. It's the usual, the default. The most spectacular sight in this museum is not the Artemisian bronze, which the archaeologists fighting around it, whether it's Zeus preparing to throw a lightning or whether it's Neptune holding a trident, nor is it the mask of Agamemnon, the king who set out and moved all the Greeks to try and conquer Troy. It's a severely corroded lamp of bronze. We saw it in an earlier talk, constructed around the 2nd century BC, about the size of a Mac Mini. In common with the Mac Mini, and amazingly, it shares commonality apart from its size. It is, or rather, it used to be a computer, as we heard. But unlike the Mac Mini, it was portable. It could drive two display units. And actually, one of the displays even had primitive 3D graphics support. And it performed calculations that we nowadays handle with differential equations. I find this more remarkable. To my surprise, as I studied the device's design and construction, I could see in it elements that we find today in electronics design, in digital circuits, in optimization, and in software engineering. Today, we'll see together three things associated with the device. First, it's a modern history, for we know next to nothing regarding its ancient provenance. That will give you some reasons of why this might be the case. Then I will describe the device's remarkable functionality, what it actually did. And finally, I will describe the device's operation by means of an open source emulator that I've developed. Let me, however, take things from the beginning, from the modern beginning. Shortly before the Easter of 1900, a group of six sfugarades, that's sponge divers, and 22 oarsmen, from the Greek, almost barren island of Symi. You see there's not a lot of vegetation there and not many other things from which they derive their living, and that's why they became sponge divers at that time. They sailed into Kaikia, Kaix, cutters, from their island, that's the north of Rhodes, so it's about here, just off the coast of Turkey, to fish off the Tunisian waters off the coast of Africa. On their return journey, they encountered very rough weather in the infamously hostile waters between the Greek mainland of Peloponnese and the island of Crete. So they took shelter in the Gulf of the northern eastern part of the small island of Antikythera. Antikythera means opposite Kythera, which is a slightly bigger island, but again, nothing very large. It's a similarly small island. Notice the treacherous rocks at the island's entrance. They are important for the rest of our story. As the crew members were fasting for the approaching Easter, you're supposed to fast in the Orthodox tradition 40 days before Easter, and at that time they were holding that tradition, a group of them went around the nearby Cape of Glyphadia or Vlichadia to dive for some cephalopods, which by tradition can be eaten during the fasting period. The rules allow them to be eaten. However, instead of surfacing with lunch, the diver, Ilias Stadiakis, emerged terrifying, saying that he saw on the bottom of the body of the sea a dead woman and a horse. The captain of the board initially thought that this was a result of hypoxia, when you don't breathe enough oxygen. At that time, they didn't have bottles with oxygen with them. You hallucinate. And when he dived to find out what was going on, he found the remnants of a shipwreck. The divers returned home. They didn't have a chance to eat this lovely octopus, and contacted the Greek government for their compensation and arranged conversation and a salvaging operation to take out the wreck and the things that were in it. The divers thus returned in November 1900 for a naval archaeology expedition. This was something not very common at that time. With them, the Hellenic Navy transport ship Mykale accompanied them in order to help them hoisting heavy elements from the seafloor. However, it proved quite difficult to approach those rocks and help them, so the ship quickly returned back to Piraeus with news and the first findings. This was the way communications were handled at that time, so when the ship returned, newspapers started publishing things about what was going on. Nobody tweeted about it. The men worked for 9 months with very primitive diving equipment. You see here a rock that is held in front to move them down, often under very gruesome weather. One actually died during the expedition, and two of them were crippled for life. The technology for decompression was known at that time in Western Europe, but hadn't reached and been communicated to those poor divers. The numerous findings were of the wreck were transported to Athens, and they were stored at the National Archaeological Museum, the same building you saw earlier on. Among the antiquities salvaged was what was described as philosopher's head, probably because of this weird look in his eyes. Clearly has to be a philosopher. And the bronze statue of a young man known as the Antikythera Ephib, a really good, very nice example of a statue. Probably those findings are the result of retail trade. They were copies of earlier statues and were the result of retail trade between colonies, between mainland Greece and colonies in Italy. So they were not originals, but they were what we would nowadays call souvenirs. With the excitement of the early findings, it took almost 2 years for somebody to recognize some gears in a formless lamp. So you see here the lamp, and you see something round on it which looks like a gear. Initial theories, and this is the other slide we share with the previous talk, suggested that this was an early example of an astrolabe. This is an astronomical instrument that can locate and predict positions of heavenly bodies and determine local time or latitude. One or the other, you can't do both. It took a long time to be able to do both and the advancement of timepieces. In the 50s, the mechanism drew the attention of Derek de Sola Price, a gifted Yale professor, whose other great contribution, some of you who may know, is the establishment of centometrics, the study of studying citations and how one paper refers to the other, which brings us to the dreaded impact factor, which is now thrown upon us. He spent almost 20 years studying the mechanism very systematically. Here you can see them pictured with a model of the mechanism he proposed. To study the mechanism, he collaborated with an epigraphologist to study the mechanism's inscriptions. And more remarkably, he was the first to use X-ray imaging radiographs to study the mechanism. Here you can see the mechanism mounted at the National Archaeological Museum for study in front of this strange contraption, which is an X-ray machine, or how an X-ray machine looked at that time. Here's one of the radiographs that he used. We'll see later on much more advanced pictures that were taken on by later studies. Price published his findings in a 70-page monograph in 1974. I recommend it to you as a reading. It's excellently written, very clearly, and it actually tells a story about the mechanism and the study together. It's an example of scholarship we rarely find in our days. Price correctly recognized that the mechanism was enclosed in a box, and it was driven by a crank on its side and contained a dial on the front side and a number of dials on the back side. He got all those things correct from his study. He also published a complete model of the mechanism's gears, in which he proposed that a large gear worked like a differential, the things we have in our cars to let them turn, make turns without the tires slipping. This is a mechanical arrangement that we first see more than a millennium after the mechanism. Although this theory regarding the differential was later disproved, the method of his study has been the base of most of modern work. More recently, an international project studied the mechanism in depth using more modern technology. Technology really helped them. Their work was published in 2006 and 2008 in Nature, no less, and forms the more accurate understanding that we have today of the mechanism. It is the basis of the model that I built. Let me tell you here that people who publish in Nature or Science one article, not let alone two, walk, they don't walk on Earth, they walk about 1 foot above Earth, they levitate above mere mortals. So this is very remarkable achievement of that team. The researchers based their work on the mechanism's 82 fragments. Some of them, actually, they're not sure that they're part of the mechanism or not, but this is exactly what is available to study. You see the big lump on the left, but there are other pieces that are clearly related to the mechanism, and on the lower right, you see some parts that may or may not be related. To study the innards of the blob, they used digital radiographs. Hold your breath here, three-dimensional X-ray microfocus computed tomography, which is a fancy way to say it's analogous to the machine that does tomography on people, but used more advanced and used on this mechanism, and computed radiography. Here's the fragment being mounted for study at the device called built by X-Tech Systems Blade Runner. It's an X-ray machine, specialized. And in collaboration with HP, they used polynomial texture mapping. You see it here in action, to study the surface interactively under a variety of lighting conditions. So what this does is creates a 3D model of the mechanism, and it allows you interactively to see how and light poor light from various angles, and this allows you to better see various aspects of it and decipher the lettering or the gear arrangement. Based on their input and painstaking deciphering of the inscription, the lettering at the various dials, with red here you can see what they deciphered, with blue is what they guessed, and we'll see that later on as well. And accompanying user manual, there was a user manual on the machine. It was on the sides of the box as it opened, which was very clever. I used to operate as a student in an IBM terminal, which had the user manual under the keyboard. You pulled it, and there was a small booklet there, which you can read. And this seems to me a similar arrangement. You opened the doors, and there was a user manual at the sides of this mechanism. And together with this, the researchers established the functionality of the mechanism. You can see here that it's roughly similar to what Price had proposed in the 70s. So again, we have a big dial on the left, two other dials on the back side of the mechanism, and the doors that open are the user manual. They also had the model of the operation that takes into account all the recent findings. Note here as well the superficial similarity with the model used by Price. So the way they drew it is the same. The actual operation is quite different. Let me move on to the functionality. What does this mechanism do? It's not an astrolabe as the people at the beginning of the 20th century thought. On the front side, there was a dial that contained a dial moving along an Egyptian calendar. This contains 365 days, so it's 12 months of 30 days plus 5 additional days, slightly different than what we do today. And it's based on the dawn rising of the Sirius star. This was very important for the Egyptians. The scale seemed to be able to move one position every 4 years, so you could remove it, and there was a small, you could lock it with a pin on its bottom side, and you could move it every 4 years to take into account the leap years. A second concentric dial within this front display was graded with the Greek names of the zodiac cycle. And this dial showed the moon's position along the zodiac, the so-called anomalistic month. So it's where the month is without, with respect to the stars around it, but not taking into account the Earth's movement around the sun. Remarkably, this position takes into account the fact that the moon moves with a variable speed and also along an ellipse. And the fact that the ellipse is apsids, so it's two centers, rotate and make a full circle every 9 years. So this is a very complicated motion, and the device could capture this motion, this very complicated motion. We'll see later on how it could do that. The device could also indicate the phase of the moon through the relative positions of the sun and the moon. And to give you an idea of the calculation's complexity, here is the corresponding source code from the BSD Unix pump command, phase of the moon command. So this is how we nowadays calculate the phase of the moon, and the device could actually calculate it using a obviously different arrangement. It didn't have a mathematical coprocessor to do these operations. Don't worry about this complexity, because a man wiser than myself once wrote, you are not expected to understand this. The mechanism uses a much simpler arrangement. Here you can see the front face of the emulator we'll see. You can see the Egyptian calendar at the outer circle and the zodiac within the inner circle. The two dials, which you see here, the outer one shows the position and the advancement of the sun along the zodiac circle. The other one shows the position of the moon and also the phase of the moon. You see here it's beginning to disappear slightly. Here is also the front face from a modern-day bronze reconstruction that Wright at the Science Museum in London built. He has developed a theory that the mechanism did more than what I'll tell you and what the other scientists have proposed, that it could actually display the positions of more planets. And so you see, therefore, more dials here. We don't have evidence for that. He has constructed this based on a number of plausible arguments, but there's no hard evidence that could actually show the positions of more planets. On the right-hand side, you could also see the knob for turning the main dial. So that's the input of the device. On the back face, there are a number of dials. Two large ones form spirals, like the one you see here. This increases the display's resolution because it allows the dial to move along the spiral around and around and moving outward toward the outward position of the spiral. So you can have more positions shown because on each rotation you move one round, one position outside the spiral, and you can show more things. This spiral here could display the day and time on which the moon or a sun eclipse would occur, by means of a so-called Saros cycle. This was a cycle devised by the ancient Babylonian astronomers. It repeated itself every 18 years and comprises about 223 and one-third synodic months, so months of the moon making, returning to the same position. So after 18 years, you can reset this and perform the calculation and know the eclipses again. The small dial that you see within the spiral corresponds to a larger cycle, a 54-year cycle called Exeligmos, which will show us the number of hours we need to add in order to get the eclipse's time, because the eclipse repeats every 18 years and a third. We need to add 8 hours every cycle to get the eclipse's time. It shifts by 8 hours every round. Notice that the Antikythera mechanism didn't actually calculate when an eclipse occurs, because this could have been too complicated. Instead, as we say today, as we do today to implement complex functions in hardware, it used a pre-computed lookup table. They knew when the eclipses occurred, they marked them on a pre-computed table, and this is how it predicted the eclipses. I find this a remarkable thing. The second dial is associated with the establishment of a civil calendar. So calendar is a difficult thing to do, especially when you don't have digital clocks and things like that. Ideally, we'd want the calendar to be based on the lunar synodic month, so to see the moon repeat itself from one phase to the same similar phase, from, say, full moon to full moon, so that we can easily track time. Ah, it's full moon again, 1 month has passed. And also on the tropical year, so that the seasons align themselves, so that we have always at the same month winter or summer or spring. We don't want to have spring one time in January, and the next time in December, and the next time in August. This can wreak havoc with agriculture. It was something extremely important at that time. So Meton, an Athens astronomer, who also made this solar clock that used to be here, devised such a calendar by simple observation. He noticed that 19 tropical years, so rotations of the Earth around the sun, contain 235 synodic months, so the moon repeating itself from one phase to the similar phase, and 6,139 days. There is nothing deep here. This is just the numbers that happen to describe the movements of the heavenly bodies. However, a synodic lunar month is not exactly 29 days, 29.5 days, so some months, 125 according to Meton, have to have 30 days, and others, 110 months, have to have 29 days. This is done by deleting a day every 64 or 65 days. A year of 12 months is 11 days shorter than a tropical year, so again, we must do something. We add a month every 3 years. And also Kallippos, later another astronomer, noticed that a day is still missed after every 76 years, so we need to do another adjustment as well. So the device actually captures this complicated calendar. We do better nowadays, but this is how it worked at that time. The spiral contains 235 month names corresponding to this 19-year period. Here you see the repeated months. So this month F Clios is repeated a number of times along this cycle. You see also with the lettering how much the scientists who studied the mechanism guessed. All the blue ones is guessed lettering. Only the red parts are parts they actually read. And from that, they constructed the model. And the numbers on the inside of the spiral indicate the day number that is excluded from the months that fall on the same radius. So when the dial falls on one of those numbers, we exclude that day. Once you know it, how to use it, you can follow the calendar. It's complicated, but again, the way it works is not that difficult. In addition, one smaller dial probably tracked the adjustment needed required for the Kallippic calendar, so this larger 54-year cycle rotating every four metonic cycle. So once the spiral goes round and round and round and reaches the outer part of the radius, then the inner dial will move one position. And a second dial pointed the years on which various athletic events took place, most notably the Olympics, from our perspective, which happened every 4 years, but there were also other games that happened there, Pythmia, Isthmia, Nemea, and so on. But the Olympics were, for the ancient Greeks, the most important ones. They stopped war, actually, during the Olympic Games to gather there and fight just to have an olive branch on their head and no sponsoring whatsoever. Okay, here you see a depiction of people taking part in the Olympic Games at that time. As you probably have noticed, that this strange spiral display occurred twice and used in slightly different functions in two ways. And to me, this is a mark of a design pattern used 2 millennia before the Gang of Four published their seminal book. Let me now move on to the operation of the device. How can we learn and experiment with this remarkable mechanism? One approach is to build it. And this is what we were discussing earlier during the break. People have done it, but for most of us, it's a difficult proposition. Filing and messing around with bronze gear is not easy. Wright has done it, and others have done it, but it's not something, at least, I cannot do. Another common one you'll find examples on the internet is to simulate it, to write software that looks like the mechanism. This is fine for a demo. It looks impressive, especially if you rotate it in 3D. But it's unsatisfactory because this similarity is only skin deep. Recognize this picture? It's the fake windows that the fake window shutters in this hotel. I don't know if you've noticed, they don't actually close. They are just there, and they cannot actually close because they don't cover the full length of the windows. They may look cute, but we can't learn anything about the functioning or the functionality of the shutters or the mechanism through such a simulation. So the best approach is to construct an emulator that follows closely the mechanical properties of the original. So let's see how one could build an emulator and how I built an emulator using an environment called Squeak eToys. So some terminology, what is a Squeak? It's Smalltalk in the 21st century. It's an implementation of Smalltalk in Smalltalk. It's based on a virtual machine, as most things nowadays. It runs bit identical images on any platform, and that's a good, that's very useful. And on top of Squeak, we have eToys. What is eToys? It's a visual programming environment. We've seen a number of these in earlier invited talks. It's influenced by things like Logo, Smalltalk, HyperCard. It's built on top of Squeak, and it's very suitable for building learning activities, learning by doing. It has influenced other environments like Scratch, we saw yesterday, and Croquet. eToys is based around one simple basic idea. We have just one interface mechanism. It's available everywhere, and it's controlling everything. There's no distinction between producers and consumers of an activity, a game, something that to learn from. So children can both explore and change what they are seeing. That's very important. Most famously, eToys is one of the main applications used as examples of constructivism learning in the OLPC project. And it is the way that I find myself studying the Antikythera mechanism. I constructed the emulator to understand what was written in those formidable Nature articles and to test constructivism learning in practice, so to see, to experiment with constructivism learning on myself. It worked beautifully. I learned a lot. I learned how the mechanism works. Unfortunately, I also found that the emulator was too complicated for as a children activity, and it also taxed the OLPC's moderate processor to its limits. So it was a wonderful experience, and you can try it on your machines. It's not something I would recommend running on an OLPC, at least the full mechanism with all the gears operating concurrently. See here an example how truthful the object-oriented metaphor of eToys is. I've used the object manipulation facilities of eToys to rotate a menu and an editor window. I beg you to ponder, can we do this in a modern environment on your Mac OS X or Windows or KDE you are running? So which other modern environment has maintained this integrity of design? I find this truly remarkable, and this is something we should keep in our minds. So how do we program in eToys? Everything in eToys is an object. All objects have similar properties, at least the main properties are similar. We modify those properties by direct manipulation, and programming is just the changing of those properties. Here are some of the objects that are available. So we have everything from multimedia objects to basic shapes to a very interesting measurement thing that we can measure, with which we can measure voltage coming into the audio port of the OLPC and various other things. And here's how we can manipulate the object properties. Changing an object's properties is programming. So you see on the right side the various properties, and we can directly go and change them. So before Java and C++, this was object-oriented programming, just changing an object's properties. Let me show you an example here. I will draw an iPhone because it's easy to draw. Okay, I said it's easy. And now by clicking here, I get a set of buttons with which I can manipulate, I can change the size. But most importantly, I can open a viewer that gives me all the properties, so I can click and make it go forward or turn. And by dragging those properties off the screen, I can create a program. So this is a program. If I click, it moves forward by 5 and turns by 5. And if I can also have it run continuously, and you can see the properties on the right changing as this iPhone rotates around the screen. eToys lacks sophisticated data structures, mathematical functions, bitmap drawing primitives, arrays, and things like that. So this forces us to use facilities that children and even children can understand. So for example, I avoided using trigonometry or vector calculus, which also I have difficulty understanding. So how can we build a complex functional gear arrangements in such a simplistic environment like this arrangement? It turns out it's not that difficult. All we need is to have a way to construct gears, a way to organize them, and a way to make them rotate. So three basic abstractions. And once we can make those, we can make anything complicated we need. Abstraction is a really powerful metaphor. So here is how we can create a gear out of a polygon. This is what eToys offers us. What we do is we remove all the vertices, and when we repeat a number of times, we insert a vertex at one position, we increase x and y, we add another vertex, we then increase x but decrease y, and so we have created one tooth of this gear, and we repeat this a number of times. Let's see this in action. You see here the gear being constructed with one tooth after the other. And this is this small program, which again I created simply by dragging these properties to the screen. Placing gears at specific positions is also easy. We define 5 placements, north, south, east, west, and concentric. 2 gears can also operate being on the same center. See here on the top that places B1 to the north of a specified other gear, so it's very simple. We just find the radius of the gear and we place it such a distance away. That's all there is to it. and at the bottom, the complete code for setting the lunisolar calendar, the calendar I showed you earlier. It's just an arrangement of years placed one in a specific position of the other. So M1 is on the east of L2, M1 is on the west of L2, M2 is a year with 15 teeth, M2 is on the same center of M1, N1 is a year with 53 teeth, N1 is on the north of gear M2, N2 is a gear with 15 teeth, and so on and so forth. Nothing very difficult to it. It's very declarative. It follows exactly the mechanism's description. When I wrote this, I simply looked at the best description of the Nature article, much magnified in order to make out the number of gear, of teeth on each gear, and I just followed the instructions. With gears, we can calculate ratios. So if gear A has 24 teeth and the other gear has 16, we have the ratio 24 by 16 by 16, which is 3 over 2. To make gears rotate in synchrony, there are two cases. Here I'm cheating a bit, but both are remarkably easy to handle. Concentric, so when they operate on the same, they're on the same center, the same axle, and they rotate together, we just maintain the heading. So we say that the heading of P2 is the heading of one other gear. When they are overlapping and they are engaged, one gear is engaged with the other, then we rotate them when they are overlapping. So when they are not overlapping, they are okay. As soon as one touches the other, we need to rotate the other a bit so that it doesn't touch anymore. And that's all there is to it. Let's see how it works in practice, the rotation part. So here the blue turns. As soon as it touches the red gear moves a bit so that the blue gear stops touching it. And so we see here that the gears operate on the mechanical principle that one gear cannot overlap with the other. That cannot happen in real physics and cannot happen on our screen. And once we write this code, which is, as you see, very easy, test if B2 is overlapping with another gear. And if it is overlapping, turn it and try that again, simply recursion, as long as it is overlapping. And it rotates until it stops overlapping. So this emulates the actual physical mechanical property of the gears. Having seen our building blocks, let's see how the mechanism is built and how we can construct the emulator. These are the connection, the mechanism's known gears, and formed in a diagram. On the left, you see the input. So the first gear on the left, gear A1, is the input gear, and the crank that one rotates. And along the various parts, you see the outputs, the Metonic and Calypic calendar, the Olympiad, the Saros and Exeligmos eclipse prediction, and the moon position and phase. I will go over each part in detail. The mechanism clearly shows a modular design. The gears are organized in a number of blocks. You can see them marked here. On the top, you see the calendars. Then there is the eclipse module. On the bottom, there's the Hipparchos mechanism. This is a mechanism for taking into account the elliptic rotation of the moon. And remarkably, we can also see evidence of reuse. See here how the block, the gear M1, sends its output to two other modules. M1 and E3 feed from more than one module. This is eerily reminiscent of how we nowadays reuse signals in digital design. For instance, in a full adder, we use the half adder's bit to calculate both the sum and the carry. The same thing was used in the Antikythera mechanism 2 millennia years ago. So here is one part of the mechanism, the Metonic calendar. So there are an arrangement of gears, and this is how they work. First of all, we have an arrangement that goes from B2 to L1 to L2 to M1 to M2 to N1. And this achieves a rotation of 5 turns every 19 years. Then there's the Calypic calendar that goes from N1 to N2 to P1 to P2 to Q1. And this allows the calendar to turn once every 4-5 turn Metonic cycles. So this is the offset that I told you earlier on. And we also need to calculate the Olympiad in order to go to the Olympic Games. So this is the arrangement N1, N3, O1, which is one turn every 4 years. This is how we set up the gears. So I showed you an example earlier on. It's simple arrangements. There's nothing very deep about it. Sometimes you see something, do menu item, bring to front. This is simply to make the display be more visually appearing, to have the gears be shown in order that we can see what is happening. But the actual operation of the gears that isn't affected by that, we just need to place them in the correct position, and then everything else happens automatically. This is how we operate the gears, an example. So this is a more complete example of how we operate the gears. See, look at the bottom part. M2 has the same heading as M1 because they are positioned together. N1 adjusts itself counterclockwise based on how M2 touches it. N2 has the same heading as N1. N3 has the same heading as N1. N1, N2, and N3 are all on the same axle. P1 adjusts its heading following N2, and so on and so forth. I cheat here a bit in the sense that I write in software whether a gear rotates clockwise or anti-clockwise when another gear touches it. This is the only cheating I do. Other than that, the mechanics operate the mechanism. The mechanism operates following mechanical principles. Let's see it here work in practice. So the big yellow gear is the one that is turned with the crank by a smaller gear. And you see here the other gears turning. And this is the part of the calendar. The eclipse prediction works by, as I said, following the Saros cycle, which is four turns every 223 synodic months. You see the reuse here, M3 and M1. We used them earlier on for the calendar. Materials and calculations were expensive at that time, so we reuse it here for the Saros cycle. We need 235 synodic months in 13 years, and this is achieved by having B2 move L1, L2, M1, M3, E3, E4, F1, F2, and G1. We also need this other larger cycle, the Xeligmos dial, which turns once every three Saros turns, of four turns each. And this is happening through the sequence G2, H1, H2, I1. This calculates the ratio 1 over 12. Again, let us see how it works in practice. You see the yellow gear now it's covered, but you see the other gears. And you see them actually turning in the way we would expect them to. I've added small indentation, a small arrow in every gear so that we can actually see what is turning. These are the back gears with a spiral dial. Let's again see them move. Notice that the Olympia dial on the right is the only one that turns counterclockwise. This shows an economy of design. It happened in this way because it was difficult to add another two gears to make another one gear to make it rotate in the correct direction. They thought it doesn't matter. Rotation is rotation, so they had it rotate counterclockwise. So you saw here the dials moving outward on the spiral as they moved. The left has the eclipses marked on it. The eta sign Ilios marks an eclipse of the sun. The sigma sign Selene marks an eclipse of the moon, and on some months is an eclipse of the moon and the sun on the same month. I hope this warm-up made you feel better in order to tackle some more difficult and tricky code. Because it is tricky. I remind you to calculate the position of the moon. And we had this difficulty with the eclipse, and the eclipse is rotating, and so on. And this is tricky. First, we need to establish the sidereal month, so the moon moving around in plane rotation without taking into account and moving it on the same position around the stars. And in a period of 19 years, the moon will have performed 235 synodic rotations. And another 19 because of its rotation around the sun, because the moon also rotates around the sun, we need another 19 to add another 19. So the total is 254. This is the ratio calculated by the sequence B2, C1, C2, D1, D2, E2. And notice how E2 ends up being located near the same center as B1. because this will be useful. Let's see how it works in practice, the gears actually moving. We have here another large gear moving in response to the smaller ones, and this was needed to perform a very difficult, to calculate a very difficult ratio. Now, let's move to the complex stuff. As I said, the moon rotates around the Earth in an elliptical orbit. And so as you can see here, its size and velocity, also the velocity change depending on whether it is on the apogee, so far from the Earth, or the perigee near the Earth. And worse, the solar tide makes the eclipse, this ellipse rotate every 9 years. So not only does it do a strange rotation, it moves in a strange way, but this strange way also rotates itself. And this sidereal rotation is established on gear E2. We had it earlier on, and is transferred up to a gear E5. You see it there in the center, which is mounted on the same axle. See the right side there. And then gear E5 turns K1. You see K1 on the top, the yellow gear. And here comes the remarkable part. K1 has a pin mounted on it, and a small distance from its center, this pin is located. Gear K2 is mounted below K1. Above it here, we can see it in order to be able to see it. It has a slot, and it's located in the center, slightly away from the center of K1. So K1 and K2 are mounted slightly, the center of one is mounted slightly away from the other. The pin moves within the slot, and this is what moves K2. So the pin touches K2, and it makes K2 rotate. And because the pin is, you know, sometimes near the center and sometimes away from the center, this changes the speed with which K2 rotates. Also, in order to model this rotation, see some heads moving here in disbelief, I remind you that we also need to rotate this ellipse. And the way we do this is those two gears are mounted on the larger gear you see around, E3, which rotates. And as it rotates, then we have the movement of the rotation of the ellipse. But because it rotates, we can't drive a display from it, okay? Because the answer we want is moving around. So the answer is sent back toward the center. So K2 drives E6, which is on a fixed axis, and this allows us to drive a display. Imagine if your computer moved, you would have the cable to the monitor and you couldn't be able to show stuff. So gear E6 drives E1, which is located at the front dial side of E3, and B3 moves the rotation clockwise to the front dial's center. So a computer engineer would say that the sequence EC, E6, E1, B3 interfaces the processing unit to the display unit, the DVI cable. The actual gears, not the ones I've used in my emulator, for simplicity I avoided that, were very carefully sized in order that the distances would add up correctly and bring the center back to the position where it could drive the display. Again, this reminds me of the corresponding PCB and VLSI design rules to match exactly the lengths of the traces so that the signals don't drive a different, don't take different time to arrive at their destination. Here's how the system works in fast action. You see that the blue gear rotates slowly and fast depending on whether the pin is near or far its center. And you can also see it rotating around as the other light blue gear rotates slowly every 19 years, as I said. So each rotation of each fast slow rotation is one moon cycle, and the other one is the 19 year period. The orange wheel rotating in the center is the one on the front of the mechanism showing when there is the phases of the moon. I will show it later on. So you see now all the gears operating. Again, this follows the exact mechanical principles of the operation. Nothing is simulated here. All is actual. All follows the actual mechanical principles. This is a fast motion. It actually took me about 2 hours to run this stuff, because obviously there is a lot of calculation going on behind it. And here, the gears still operate on the background because we need them in order to drive the display because it's, as I said, real. And we have the one dial showing the zodiac position and the other showing the position of the moon. And as you see, the phase of the moon also changes. We can see it when we have full moon and when we have a new moon. This was done in actual practice by having a small sphere rotating around its center. So on the one side, the sphere was white, and on the other, it was black or gold. And by rotating, it showed the changing phase of the moon. I used a slightly different arrangement here due to limitations of the software I was using, but the principles, again, are roughly similar. Again, you see the gears operating on the back in order to drive this display. If you want to try this out, you can download the code from the location from the URL you see here. When you launch it with eToys, you can obviously download eToys as well. There are images available pre-compiled for various operating systems. You will see a control panel, so you can press individual buttons to see just the calendars or only the eclipse mechanism or only the gears driving the back gears or the pointer follower mechanism, the spirals, or just the lunar part or the complete hipparchos mechanism with the moon phase. And also you can see the front dials or the back dials, so you can explore different parts of the mechanism individually. Let me end this presentation by discussing a question. What was the purpose of this device? This is something I'm often asked. I will disappoint you here. Probably we will never know. Some have suggested that it was predicting eclipses, and this could have political and religious value. Often eclipses at that time were considered a sign from the gods. They are referred in the Trojan War that Zeus wanted to send a sign, and so he sent an eclipse, and everybody stopped and wondered what that was. So they could have an obvious value at that. Or perhaps this meant that, the device was shrouded in secrecy because it was a military secret, confidential. And maybe this explains why we haven't encountered any other references to it. It was classified. Some others have suggested astronomy. Predicting eclipses could allow astronomers to measure longitude on a world scale. However, astronomers already knew the events that this device calculated, so there was not a lot of value in that either. Others have suggested navigation. This is an actual trirem reconstructed faithfully with materials and tools that were available at the time. But the device was quite delicate to carry on a small boat, like this one, and its technology was plainly excessive for the purposes of navigation. We saw earlier other devices that were quite as good as that. So perhaps a more plausible explanation is that somebody built it as an educational tool for fun. In order to demonstrate that such a tool could be built, because a hacker thought it could make a cool demo. To me, it seems that a great gear hacker, born 2 millennia ago, loved computing as much as we do. Thank you. Obviously open to answer questions.
So what's the relative complexity of this device compared to any other device from the antiquities that we've discovered and analyzed?
What's the relative complexity of the device? It's on a different scale. So we don't have other devices that are similar, either devices that we have found or descriptions that we have seen. The intellectual infrastructure for the device was there, so the mathematics we've found references to it. Greeks and Pythagoras were playing numbers very well, and the ratios, that was easy stuff for them. But the mechanics and the complicated arrangements, this is something that we don't have anything similar like that. We have similar devices in more modern years. So during the Middle Ages and the Enlightenment, there were devices of similar complexity constructed, but nothing like that at that time.
This business of predicting solar eclipses confuses me, because if you look at modern lists of solar eclipses, there are little bits in Alaska and Greenland and Antarctica and so on. Were these solar eclipses that they saw in Greece, was this only useful in one area? I mean, clearly they've taken a long history of solar eclipses to write their lookup table.
What were the eclipses that they used? I don't think I can answer that. I can guess that it was local knowledge, not what one would observe in Alaska.
You just mentioned this. I was going to ask about a clock that Carlo Dodondi built in the Renaissance to simulate the motions of the planets. And I was wondering if there's a sort of similar construction and mechanism behind a clock such as that, and the Antikythera, the mechanism.
If I understand correctly, your question is whether this construction is similar to one that can show the position of the planets. And this is exactly what Wright has indicated, that in order to find the position of the planet, you need again a similar thing to rotate, to have a gear rotating, and on the gear another instrument that rotates again and feeds that back in. So what we saw for the moon, you need that such an arrangement for each planet. So what Wright has said is that it was quite expensive to build this once and just for the moon, and probably there were similar arrangements for the other planets as well. So I think there is a similarity.
So towards the end, you had demonstrated the phases of the moon, but I thought you said that they used a sphere.
Yes.
There's evidence of them actually using a sphere and then converting the rotation in the gears out into the dial?
That's the sphere. There's no evidence of the sphere. This is a hypothesis. Okay. But there is evidence that both the position of the moon and the phase of the moon were fed upward. So once you have those two, you can easily subtract them by having something rotate around and subtracting the position of the moon with the phase and with the position of the sun, and this gives you the phase of the moon. So once you have those two, it's very easy to subtract them, and the most plausible mechanism to do that is by having a sphere rotate by the difference of those two values. You already have those in the front display, so it would make little sense to do anything else but to subtract them and indicate the phase of the moon, and the small sphere is the easiest way to do that.
How fragile would this have been? I mean, you said it's the size of a Mac Mini, which is pretty small. What are the total number of gears in the system?
About 30. I've seen Wright, who has built a physical construction, build it and assemble it and disassemble it in front of people. It doesn't seem very fragile, so he routinely takes it apart and then in half an hour builds it together. And it also looks remarkably resilient and sturdy, so you can actually turn and it doesn't jam or block. So this also shows that those who designed it did the mechanics in the right way. No crashes and blue screens of death.
I was going to ask you about bugs, any bugs that you may have.
Thank you very much.